Earl Slick. Let's talk to Earl. Earl is one of the notable guitarists of rock. He played with David Bowie a lot and John Lennon, among others, the New York Dolls for a while, a long list. He also sold timeshares for a few years in the 1990s when things weren't going so well musically before Bowie came calling once again. Earl played on some of the big Bowie albums and songs. That was the era of Earl's first era with Bowie, although he wasn't playing saxophone there. He was beside David Bowie on three of the 70s Bowie albums, David Live, Young Americans and Station to Station, and then three more of the later ones, Heathen, Reality and The Next Day, which I suppose Bowie fans will know. Bowie's unreleased album from 2001, Toy, which was a mixture of new songs and new versions of his earlier songs, is finally getting an official release. And Bowie was said to be so hurt by Virgin EMI not releasing the record that he left the label. Earl Slick played on that album too. Earl lives in New York. He's heading out on the road soon again, on the way to London with his band and with a new album, his first in a long time. Hello, Earl. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning.
Nice to talk with you, and thanks for joining us. First of all, can you take us back to the recording of Toy? Because you'd just come off a bunch of gigs, I think, and the band was firing on all cylinders, and you say there was something of an unspoken operating system among the musicians at the time. You kind of just looked at one another, or Bowie would look at you and things simply happened. And that suggests a pretty magical sort of rapport. That must be a great feeling for a muso.
It was. It was all the right guys. Everything was right about that. And, you know, of all the years I worked with David, we operated on that sort of very little verbal going on, you know. We just somehow we could communicate very easily without having to go through, you know, a whole dissertation about stuff. Makes it work much better for me.
The whole dissertation, yes, we can imagine.
You know, some guys will sit there, and if you're going to do a part and you're going to do a song, they'll go through 20 minutes of details, which none of which are really necessary to make the track work.
What happened with the non-release of this album? So much energy into it, and you all felt great about it. What happened with the non-release?
I can give you scenarios 1 through 10. I don't know.
And I've read scenarios 1 through 10 as well. Record company nervousness usually is at the bottom of everything, whatever the reasons were. Yeah, I imagine you'd know that from your time.
Hell yeah. I mean, that's what I love right now. I'm with an indie label, and that doesn't exist. It's so easy.
You'd been playing together with David Bowie on and off for a quarter of a century. By that stage, Toy came off the back of a Glastonbury appearance in the year 2000, which the New Musical Express called the best headline slot at any festival ever. That must have been a moment or two for you, Earl.
It was a trip, man. It was, you know, in the heat of the moment, you don't realize that, you know, you've made a little bit of history. You just don't realize it until later, you know. In hindsight, it has more impact on me than it did while we were doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You were plucked from relative obscurity to replace Mick Ronson as the Bowie's sideman guitarist. And you were only 22. And at the time, he was considered the personification of the glam rock guitar hero, wasn't he? So no pressure back then on you, Earl.
No, none whatsoever. You know, out of all of the worries that I had when I got that gig was how David's fan base was going to view me taking over from Mick, because that was a formidable guy. I mean, Mick was amazing. Everything about Mick, between his guitar playing and his production chops and the way he looked and how good of a performer he was, I was like, oh my God, they're going to kill me. They didn't. So I got lucky.
David Bowie told you to play the songs the way you see them, I have read, and not try to mimic Mick Ronson in any way. And that's what you did.
Yeah. He just let me loose to do what I did. And that was great. It really was.
you've admitted you weren't really a David Bowie fan when that surprise invitation came through to audition for the Diamond Dogs tour in 1974. So that is interesting, actually, in itself.
The only record that I had of his was the Aladdin Sane record. And the reason I got that record is because David inadvertently hit on some very traditional blues influences on that, like Panic in Detroit is Bo Diddley, you know, Gene Genie's Managed Boy. There were elements on that that were definitely coming from what I was doing, you know. And it was mixed guitar playing on that record, too, that sold me, you know. So, but that was the only one I had, so I had to become familiar with the rest of it because I wasn't.
It's funny how much it's entered our mental vocabularies. You've just taken me back to that record just by mentioning a couple of the tracks. And there was a real Bowie mania going on when you joined his band. So what an introduction for the big time for you. You must have been nervous. Was it all bewildering, or did he make it easy on you?
You know, the most unnerving part really was before the gigs, you know. I mean, I had to change the way I looked, you know, the way I dressed, everything, my hair, everything got changed to fit into the show, which was something I wasn't used to, you know. But once we got to the gigs and I got used to all of that, I wasn't that nervous at the gigs. I didn't get anything more than normal sort of that good anxiety you get before a show. You pace around, but I wasn't really nervous.
After the Diamond Dogs tour, you worked on the Station to Station and Young Americans albums, but then you were replaced in turn as lead guitarist, not because I think of any disagreement with Bowie, but with his management. Can you tell us what happened there?
They weren't really taking care of us that well, and there was also a lot of drama. It was behind the scenes stuff. I mean, me and David had no problems with each other. We never did, ever, you know. It was other people, and we both got sucked into it, and that was that. So, yeah, it wasn't us. It was all of that behind the scenes, as you say.
He sang about changes, of course, very famously. It's one of his best known songs. How did he change as a person over the course of your relationship? Was he the same Bowie at the end as he was when you began with him?
You know, in a lot of ways, no. You're also looking at the 1970s, which were insane, you know. So he, I think over the years, he got a lot more comfortable with himself, as we all did. So it was easier to communicate on a personal level.
Yeah. It's been 5 years now since he died, which...
Yeah.
Which reminds me of that lyric of his as well. And the fans, of course, are still in awe of his legacy to an unusual and reverent extent. Have you ever worked out the adoration for him? I mean, many of us have a great fondness for David Bowie, especially if it was during our formative years when we first heard him, as it was for me. But for many fans, he is still the past and future of music. It's very pronounced, that level of devotion, Earl. Have you ever worked it out?
Yeah, I do. You know, I can see that reasons that I believe that is true. He spoke for a generation of people that maybe felt they were a bit on the outside, and he gave them sort of a solidarity with each other. You know, a lot of the Bowie fans, I mean, they're so Bowie fans. To this day, it astounds me. But he gave them something more than music. You know, you can look like you want to look, all of that stuff that so much now become constant news headlines, but then it was done through the music and through the art. And he gave them sort of a platform to communicate. And I think that's what caused that, and still does, cause that such of a tether to him.
Yeah, I think that's a very articulate way of putting it. And a new kind of cohort. I mean, there'd been mods and there'd been rockers and there'd been hippies and there'd been all sorts, but he tapped into an entirely new class of person. He still had the middle ground, a lot of people who, you know, weren't outsiders, but you're right, he actually was special for them, wasn't he?
There's no doubt about that. a lot of my friends that were Bowie fans before I got the gig, and they were kind of those kind of people.
We're talking with Earl Slick on the imminent release of the David Bowie album Toy. You didn't know that he'd even been sick until you learned he had died. You'd spoken not that long before on your birthday, and he would normally email you on your birthday, but that time he called you. What do you think that meant?
What I think, I could read anything I want to read into that, but it's something he didn't normally do. I think, because he hadn't told me what was going on. I had no idea. Maybe it was his way of just saying goodbye. I mean, that's the best I could think of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Gee, and I bet you have thought about it too. You performed alongside Lord at the Brits 2016 tribute to Bowie, and he had said that Lord was the future of music. So that was undoubtedly an arrangement that he would have been comfortable with, Earl.
Oh, no doubt. You know, yeah, I mean, because at first I didn't know that there was a connection between the two of them, and I caused a bit of a ruckus when I found out that she was going to be performing with us, because I thought, well, why isn't it going to be Iggy or somebody, you know? That was his friend. But then I found out later on that, you know, that he had said that, and I thought, okay, it was his choice.
Out of interest, the best decade for music. This occurred to me to ask you when you were talking about the 1970s. Of all your decades of music, which is your favorite?
My God. I think from the 50s all the way through the 90s, each one of those decades had a lot of good stuff and a lot of artists and songwriters that really had something to say that, you know, it seemed when we got to the end of the 90s, things kind of got strange, you know, and I do have my own thoughts on why, but, you know.
Yeah, I won't go into those because we all have our own thoughts in that respect. And maybe it's because we grow older as well, Earl.
Well, part of, you know, I was thinking about that and I thought, you know, and I have two schools of thought on that, you know, because I'm very open-minded to new stuff. The 90s was the last decade where there were actually bands playing. So maybe the music is because it's electronically done, you know, the idea of musicians communicating with each other inside of the studio instead of one guy or two people in the studio, it's a different ball game. The music has become like a lot of other things. I'll use the word sort of globalized, you know. Right now, the programmers are making the music. Mm. A lot of it is programmers. Even though there are some artists that come out here and there that are writing songs, it's just changed so much. And the thing is that for somebody that's 16 years old, what's going on is just as valuable to them as Rolling Stones are to me. So it all comes out in the wash. I can't devalue it. I really can't. Just because, and also because I'm a guitarist, you know, I'm at my best when I'm in a room with the guys, you know. Yeah. It's just not like that now, you know. And even technically, an MP3 doesn't sound anything like playing a vinyl. But at the end of the day, you know, the records that I bought when I was a kid, I mean, I was listening to a lot of that stuff on a little portable transistor radio that sounded like crap, and I still bought the record. So, you know.
Yes, I do know. There was a time for Earl Slick in the early 1990s when you gave up music, you moved to Lake Tahoe, and you started work as a timeshare salesman. That must have been an odd transition.
It was so weird. I got totally burned out. And by the time we got to the early 90s, for some reason, I had it, and I hung it up and split. I started a whole new life. And probably the best thing I ever did, because ever since I got out of that and I've been back doing this, I'm more excited now than I was when I was 12 years old about doing this.
Yeah. I'm glad it worked out for you. It's certainly a notable thing to have done in a midlife crisis. Well, age, you mentioned the Rolling Stones. Age, as they have shown, is no barrier. So you're going to keep on doing this. You sound as charged as ever.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. I became really good friends with one of my big heroes about 5 or 6 years ago, Buddy Guy. And we became good friends, and I sit in with him a lot when he's on tour. And Buddy just turned 85. So, you know, I'm going, as long as you still love doing this shit, keep doing it.
What are people going, just finally, what are they going to like most about Toy when they hear it, if you were describing it to someone who, you know, was going to listen to it for the first time?
No, I think because, you know, up until recently when they announced the release of it, I hadn't listened to that stuff in years. And I thought, you know what, for a bunch of songs, a whole album of material that was written like forever ago and redone, it sounds fresh. It doesn't sound like we were trying to resurrect a bunch of old crappy songs. It sounds fresh and good. And I think that's what they're going to get out of that. This doesn't sound like a retread at all. This really sounds like a new David Bowie record.
Great to talk with you, Earl, and all the best. Thank you very much for giving us your time.
Great, man. Thank you.